You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer, and on this episode of Film Spotting SVU, we'll be discussing ESPN's miniseries OJ, Made in America, about the rise and fall of football legend turned actor turned acquitted murder suspect turned convicted armed robber, Arenthal James Simpson.
We'll also be recommending some other highlights from 30 for 30, ESPN's ongoing series of sports-themed documentaries, of which OJ Made in America is a part. All of those for streaming right now. And I wanted to say, for anyone leery about the prospect of an entirely sports-centric episode, do not be alarmed. I know very little about most professional sports and can add almost nothing to conversations about them, and you better believe that I'm going to devote part of this episode to talking about figure skating. In fact, this is all a ramp up to my ultimate goal of an entirely figure skating themed episode.
Are there really enough figure skating movies to support a whole episode?
Yes. Ice Castles, obviously. The Ice Castles remake. Ice Princess, starring Michelle Trachtenberg. Thin Ice, The Cutting Edge. The Cutting Edge 2, Going for the Gold. The Cutting Edge 3, Chasing the Dream. Blades of Glory, Blades of Courage, about a Canadian figure skater named Lori LaRoche.
Okay, I surrender.
Damn right you do. But before we get to that, we have Opening Break, the segment we do in conjunction with Movies on Demand on cable, in which we spotlight a few films that are new on demand. And Matt, you're up this time. What have you got for us, figure skating themed or otherwise?
Are there really three cutting edge movies?
There are.
Wow. I'm left reeling by that revelation. I don't know what to say. I don't know where to go from here. The Cutting Edge 3, Chasing the Dream. Wow. All right. Well, let's get to these opening break options. We've got some interesting titles here this time. The first one is a new film by this young whippersnapper, this up-and-coming filmmaker. His name is Terrence Malick, and the name of the film is Knight of Cups. It is available now on VOD. I will read you the plot description, although this might be more plot than the actual film contains. Fair warning. Rick is a film screenwriter living in Los Angeles. While he's successful in his career, his life feels empty. Haunted by the death of one brother and the dire circumstances of the other, he finds temporary solace in the Hollywood excess that defines his existence. Women provide a distraction to the daily pain he must endure, and every encounter that comes his way brings him closer to finding his place in the world. And Rick is played by Christian Bale, and the cast also includes Cate Blanchett, Natalie Portman, Brian Dennehy, Wes Bentley, Teresa Palmer, Imogen Poots, and more. I will confess, I was not a huge fan of this movie. Personally, I do like my Malick to have a little bit of plot and character, and with Knight of Cups, what you really have is more of this meditation, a tone poem. Some people might describe it as the story. Although I just read you a plot description, some of that isn't even entirely clear from the movie, I felt. The story is really as thin as a thistle blowing in a warm summer breeze. And I just didn't particularly connect with the Christian Bale character, who's very upset about something. And he spends the whole movie moping, essentially, and just kind of wandering from one woman to another, but he doesn't seem like he has that much to be upset about. But some people did adore this movie, and it is Terrence Malick. And even a bad Terrence Malick movie, or an inferior Terrence Malick movie, I think deserves serious consideration. So I would still encourage people to see this for themselves, wrestle with it themselves. And VOD is a great place to do that because you're not going to have to, you know, pay full price for the ticket. If you've got a good TV, you're still going to get a good visual experience. So that is Knight of Cups. Do you have anything to add there, Allison?
No, I don't know that I would say that my issues with it stemmed from there being a lack of plot so much as the plot that is there is like the most indulgent Hollywood angst story of all time.
Yeah, it's hard to care about this guy who's rich, apparently, never has to work.
Has all of these people coming to him.
Gorgeous women. Yes.
Who he kind of looks at for happiness and then discards, apparently, since they keep going
away.
They
keep vanishing, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like it's extremely beautiful. And I think it should be said that, like, as with all Malick movies, there are moments of just extraordinary grace.
Incredible.
But yeah, it is, I think, about the subject matter I really wish he weren't devoting all of that beauty to.
It's a little tiresome. Yeah, there are some movies where when people ask me about them, I say I didn't like it, and I tell them to stay away. And there are other movies where I say it wasn't for me, but it might be for you. And I think this is one of those cases. Some people love this movie, and it's certainly one to see for yourself and judge for yourself. That's Knight of Cups, available now on VOD. Next up, a movie that I'm very curious about because it's by a director by the name of John Watts, who made the film Cop Car and is now making, most importantly, the new Spider-Man movie, Spider-Man Homecoming. And this is the movie he made before Cop Car called Clown. It is available now on VOD. And the plot description is, a loving father finds a clown suit for his son's birthday party, only to realize that it is not a suit at all. And I do not know any more than that. I haven't seen the movie. I don't know what the suit could be beyond a clown suit, if it looks like a clown suit, but I've seen pictures of this clown, and it is very terrifying. And so I'm intrigued. I'm interested. And I still need to see Cop Car as well. But I need to bone up on the oeuvre de John Watts before Spider-Man Homecoming comes out. So I'm fully prepared. So this is Clown. I think it came out. It was made a few years ago, but just recently got a release because of the success of Cop Car and because of Spider-Man coming out as well. So, yeah, that's one to check out as well. Clown. It's available now on VOD. And finally, another sort of divisive recent movie. It is called By the Sea, directed by Angelina Jolie. The plot description of this one is, set in France during the mid-1970s, Vanessa, a former dancer, and her husband, Roland, an American writer, travel the country together. They seem to be growing apart, but when they linger in one quiet seaside town, they begin to draw close to some of its more vibrant inhabitants, such as a local bar, cafe keeper, and a hotel owner. And this was, I think it was positioned as an awards contender. It sort of went bust in that regard. I know a lot of people claimed it was a vanity project, maybe more than an art film. But again, this is a movie that's sort of like Knight of Cups, where this movie had some very passionate defenders. And personally, while I didn't get to see this one, this is exactly the sort of movie I'm always most interested in. When you have stars, in this case, Angelina Jolie, who is the director as well as one of the stars with Brad Pitt, her husband, when actors sort of inject autobiographical elements into their work and make movies that are fictional but have these sort of nakedly personal elements bubbling underneath. That's one of my favorite things, is to try to parse the fiction from the nonfiction in a movie like this. So it's one that I was bummed that I missed out on. I certainly was upset that I was hoping it would be great, because it immediately intrigued me from the premise and from the cast there. So I'm glad I get a chance now to catch up on it, and I hope I love it. I hope I can look at everybody else who didn't like it and say, you were wrong, you missed the boat on By the Sea, which is also available now on VOD.
I told him, OJ, you're breaking the laws of God. One day, everybody's going to know everything that you've done, man.
If you're a black man in America, you're fighting our war.
Ooh, sinner man, where you gonna run to?
The reality of black America and white America, two totally separate worlds.
For us, OJ was colorless.
on every episode of Film Spotting SVU, we let you pick our main review by voting on one of three options. And this time around, we gave you a set of docs. Terror, Lyric Cabral and David Felix Sutcliffe's film about an ongoing FBI sting, which is now on Netflix. Ezra Edelman's OJ Made in America on OJ Simpson, which is now available on iTunes and ESPN's app. And Raiders, the story of the greatest fan film ever made, Jeremy Kuhn and Tim Skousen's movie about the making of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the adaptation that made by teens as an act of love, a scene-by-scene recreation of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there was no competition. OJ Made in America won handily with 60% of the vote. OJ Made in America is directed by Ezra Edelman, who's done multiple films for HBO Sports and who was brought on by ESPN and pitched the project. He actually apparently at first said no, feeling like there was nothing to say about more to say about OJ, and then obviously found a lot more to say about OJ. While this aired on ABC and ESPN as a five-part miniseries, each part about feature length, it premiered in its full 464-minute form at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and then went on to also play Tribeca in the same way, like a full day of programming, breaks for snacks and meals, like a long commitment. That is a lot of time. Though, despite the episodes each having a loose focus, Simpson's rise to sports stardom, his post-football life, his marriage to Nicole Brown, the trial and its aftermath, it is really a whole story. It describes this arc, the story of O.J. Simpson, a man who was a beloved sports star and then became the center of an entirely different sort of gawking. What's most impressive about O.J. Made in America to me is the degree of context it gives to Simpson and his life. It starts with the history of L.A., in particular its fraught record when it comes to race, the LAPD, Rodney King, and then into Simpson's marketability as a black man being portrayed as and seeming to think of himself as someone who is somehow transcends race, to whom race does not apply. And then the whole blanket of celebrity and wealth and how that serves as a protective bubble. And Matt, we were both teenagers when the trial took place. And what for you were the most surprising or biggest insights that this movie slash miniseries offers? And do you feel it deserves the acclaim that it's gotten?
Second question first. Yes, I loved this film, miniseries, whatever you want to call it. In terms of what surprised me most, I mean, there's a few things. I mean, that general context, which you mentioned, I agree, is some of it you knew, some of it you didn't know. And I think you've never seen it, whether you knew a lot of it or not, seeing it all together in one place where you get that full scope of the roles that race and police abuse and brutality and all of the celebrity, as you mentioned, all these different issues that, you know, all came together because, you know, as a kid, I certainly didn't understand any of that stuff. So to see it all in one place, I think that was the most surprising thing. There are other elements that are very shocking. There are, one of OJ's friends potentially having this affair with his ex-wife and that being the source of tension.
And not just his friend, but like his mini-me.
His protege.
Yeah.
This guy that he... I don't want to spoil who it is if you haven't seen the film yet, but like that another sort of sports star who he kind of groomed as a protege and maybe had... They don't necessarily definitively say it, but it's very strongly hinted that Nicole Brown Simpson had this affair with him and that could have potentially been another element in the sort of motive. And then the other thing that I found very arresting, shocking, alarming, fascinating, all of those things, was there's a segment in the film where they, like, basically one of the police officers break down their theory of what happened in the crime while showing on screen these very graphic images of the crime scene. And it really, it's so disturbing and troubling, but it also really hits home how this potentially happened, allegedly happened, whatever you want to say, and really reinforced the idea that whoever committed this act, whoever it was, that just the amount of violence and anger and rage, and that this wasn't just a robbery gone wrong or something like that. There had to have been a lot of intense feelings behind this crime.
It was personal.
Exactly. And so to see it, to see the images, to hear the theory of how it happened really hits that home. So yeah, those were the things that I really took away as the main sort of surprises. But even the stuff that I knew before, I still think this film is incredible for putting it all in one place and making it so fascinating and so watchable for something that is so long. I mean, it doesn't feel, as you're watching it, like 7.5 hours. I mean, this is one of the most binge-watchable shows I've seen in a while. I mean, if I had the time, I would happily sit through the whole thing again in one sitting. It is just that compelling.
Yeah, it feels rich. It feels like rich with details and with history and with very relevant discussions in a way that I think it earns that runtime, certainly. But I think it also, it shows something that nonfiction, that documentary can do, you know, in a way that's so impressive, is to like weave together journalism and to weave together filmmaking and to do the research and to collect these amounts of interviews and these amounts of archival footage and to weave them all together to create this larger tapestry. I was really impressed by this. Yeah. And for me, the biggest, I don't know, surprise is maybe the wrong word, but as someone who really didn't know I knew very little about O.J. Simpson, like in my life until
as a sports figure
and as a celebrity,
right?
Even.
As the star of The Naked Gun, for example.
Like those were the parts that were like new to me in a way that I thought informed so much more about the trial that then came. The whole like the specific type of sports celebrity that he achieved, and also and all of the things about like the Hertz ads and you know, about him as like this kind of like breaking ground as a black celebrity being the center of this giant endorsement.
Right.
And also the details about how they would make him the only black person in the ad as a way to soften or make it seem like it's okay. Like,
well, or
he's
to
not,
write,
right, like
that he's,
a, not
he's
really
okay,
black.
Right,
yes,
for like that they had the old lady, the old white lady saying, go, OJ, go. And that was, in a way, it was like giving permission to white America to root for this black celebrity or to see him as a figure of endorsement.
Right. That was
fascinating.
So interesting to me. And also just the way he would talk about race and his relationship with it coming up, this idea of being like,
I'm not black, I'm OJ.
Yeah, but beyond that, even as if to bring race into your discussion of your life and your success is like, I don't know, he seemed to perceive it as a weakness somehow or something, you know, like he kept saying things about being like, I did all of the right things, you know, I did all that, like, I don't need to even discuss myself in terms of race because I'm so good and doing, you know, like have like clean, like been so like kept it so perfectly on this path that like why would you even talk about that about me? And then, and so much of, in fact, like the things that follow are about the idea of when people perceive that you can leave race out of the conversation or not. And I think the kind of foolishness of the idea that race is something that you can just divorce from everything else, you know, like repeatedly through the later parts of the miniseries, people talk about the race card.
Sure.
And I think watching this all the way through, what is clear is that you can't just, like, race is a part of day-to-day existence. You can't leave it out. The idea that it's something that you can throw on the table as, like, a trump is a ridiculous one.
I would say also that beyond the sort of the facts that you learn that you wouldn't have known before, or maybe you did, even beyond any of those sort of journalistic aspects, there is a poetic element to this. There's an element of grand tragedy. And it's specifically, I think, in a lot of this stuff about race and the way that this man, O.J. Simpson, saw himself above race and that, you know, tried to move past it, as you're saying. And yet, what happens? He gets accused of this crime, and then he essentially, as you said, plays the race card. His legal team does.
Like the focal point, and not just that, of the most like racially divisive spectacle in America.
And in doing so, becomes a folk hero to a community that has been oppressed for so long and is so desperate for some sort of victory.
And that he has distanced himself from.
Right. This group that he has done nothing for, essentially, as we see in the movie, how he refused to take part in civil rights movements that were going on all around him while he's at USC, while that area is a hotbed of those sorts of issues, that now suddenly when it's advantageous to him, he turns himself into a a folk hero of the black community, and it certainly helped him during his trial, which I think the film shows you very well. And yet after the fact, what happens afterwards is like all of these stereotypes come bubbling back up. And I just thought that the arc of this man, it by doing it in this size, this scope, 7.5 hours, you see how it's a tragedy, not just of this one man, but of this these larger issues.
Right. Well, I mean, there is a way in which also there are times in which he is almost erased from his own trial in that he becomes a symbol, right?
Right.
You know, like, and I think, and that's part of what makes what happens afterwards and the ways in which he, for a while, it seems like a very active part of the black community. And then, like, all of the support kind of, like, seems to dwindle away.
Right.
That, you know, that he was made into, and was made into a symbol and became a symbol for America also, and for black America specifically, of someone who could be a victory after, like, all of these gross injustices.
Correct.
These very public gross injustices.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that they were necessarily on board with OJ forever.
Right.
You know? That I think that, like, for that moment, like, so much of that outpouring of support and love was also to be, like,
right,
you know, we want a chance to strike back against a system that has, you know, just been, like, just filled with, like, gross unfairness and some, you know, shocking. Like, to see the Rodney King, I think, like, be put directly into that context. I was, like, very young, like, you know, young enough at the time that I think it was not filtering into me, like,
sure,
that chronology. And to see it, like, being put in there, and you're like, it seems so naive that the prosecutors didn't understand the extent to which, you know.
The way that they take two full episodes to even get to the murder, by the time the murder is committed, you both, at least personally, I personally had never been more convinced before the murder has happened and they've gone through the evidence that he did it. But also at the same time, it's never been more obvious why he got off, why he was acquitted. It's so clear before anything happens, because they spend 3 hours explaining all of this backstory, the context, that it is so obvious why he was, despite this incredible mountain of evidence, which they then show you, where you go, how could anyone be acquitted in this scenario? You already know, oh, this is how it is, that there were these issues going on. And you even had, there are talking heads in the movie who are sort of confronted with their actions now in retrospect, where I think that even they have to concede, yeah, he does look really guilty now, but that he served his purpose essentially for their cause, and it was a good cause, right? But then that brings up all these other further issues. It's like, how, what is worth doing for a good cause if it means sort of using this one trial as to further this political movement, which is important, which is, you know, beneficial to a lot of people. But if it does it at the expense of maybe this guy who perhaps did it getting off, what is that, you know, what is, does the ends justify the means?
Sure, but I think that, I don't know that OJ's win necessarily furthered anything. Mm. I don't think that it was actually, there was anything that calculated about it. I think it was very emotional, you know? And I think that that is part of what the prosecutors clearly failed to understand, which is that the kind of like deep emotional response of that, and the way that it wasn't even necessarily, this wasn't like this calculated, well, you know, we're going to push a lot. And like I think it really was like, it was a win in a very like visceral sense of just being like, well, you know, we're going to take this one for our team after like having seen so much of this go the other way.
Right.
I think that the doc actually does a good job about that. It, you know, there are two jurors that they interview, one of whom seems to clearly like reacts on like a very kind of like emotional level, and the other who's like more measured. And as much as it says at certain points, like, if they had done this case right, he would have been guilty.
Right.
But that they did not. They did not do an adequate job.
And sometimes has very good points, too.
She's
clearly thought a lot about this.
She's a very good interview.
Yeah.
I will say the other thing that something that genuinely came as a surprise, and it is, I think, the one thing that I wish that the doc had dug into a little more, when they talk about the Nicole Brown, the history of domestic violence in their relationship.
Yeah.
And even at one point, one of the jurors says like, I don't have any sympathy for a woman who doesn't get herself out of those relationships.
Yeah.
And that moment is like
shocking.
A shocking thing to say, but also I think representative of a lot of the attitude that I think was, And including, I think Mark Furman says something about that when he goes to the house and he's like, she's not going to file charges. And he's like, well, all right. Like, I don't know why you're letting yourself get treated this
right.
way. Where you're like, there's this almost like this sense that, well, you asked for this. Like, it's your fault for not extricating yourself from this.
Yeah.
That I think is like so disturbing to me, and something that I do think is like, is raised. It is obviously raised, but like is not, they do not dig into that enough.
Yeah.
This feeling that like in this trial that then becomes this like larger battle about race and like the LAPD and all of this history, this was a woman who had gotten, you know, knocked around for a long time and then was murdered, and that she is becomes like so relatively incidental to these kind of grander issues. I don't think that the doc spends as much time addressing that as maybe it could.
I agree. And I think there could be more about her in general, I think, about Nicole, and also Ron Goldman. I mean, is the victims...
He's not much of a figure in it.
No.
His parents are very
His
prominent.
His father is another interview subject that has some very powerful moments. And in general, there are some amazing characters in this film beyond just O.J. Simpson and like the sort of the main players, like O.J.'s agent who stood by him for a very long time, but now has sort of finally broken with him.
And says at one point, shocking things. He's like, I thought you did it. I always thought you did it. Back even when he was still aligned with him and was friends with him, was like, I always thought you did it.
A fascinating character. The police officer, Ship, who was sort of another close associate who kind of broke with him, has some amazing stories. And Ron Goldman's father, also an incredible character. It's just like, it's so rich with these supporting characters. Yeah. Again, makes
Peter
it feel...
Peter Himes, the filmmaker,
has some great interviews. Where I mean, Marcia Clark is a great interview throughout the film as well. You just, you know, again, the idea of it being this sort of grand Shakespearean tragedy, you have all these incredible figures who seem like they could be the subject of their own film. And I do agree that one of the... Even at 7.5 hours, there's more they could have done. And I think it is fascinating and alarming the way that this history of domestic abuse, instead of it becoming used against O.J. Simpson, where you would think it should be because it shows a pattern of and a history of abuse and
like a classic one, that is
jealousy,
like precursor,
and,
right, possessiveness,
yeah,
the showing up at like events that you'd be at afterwards.
I didn't know any of the stuff about the other boyfriend where he was like watching them all night, potentially. At least that's what the boyfriend thinks.
Yeah, I think that it's such like a classic setup for escalating violence.
Yes.
And for that kind of, yeah.
But as you say, the fact that instead of that being sort of used and held against OJ, seems to be held against her, at least, for example, by that juror, is so troubling. And yes, there could have been more there. And I'm sure if we sat here, we could probably think of a few other things. Like I said, like I felt like Ron Goldman.
Right.
I wanted to know more about that, about him, about that guy, and about her, about Nicole as well. And there's a few other things, and maybe as before we wrap up, another question I had is, obviously, OJ himself, not interviewed for the film. I think they tried to speak to him, and
he is in jail for
a
33-year sentence,
yeah,
right? Like, which is a gigantic sentence.
Yes.
As they say, like, as part of the documentary, like, is an outsized, really, sentence for what happened.
For the crime, which they cover in depth as well, and that's another thing that I didn't know a lot about. I knew the broad outlines, but that's a strange and fascinating incident as well.
The whole last chapter is
so
tremendous
sad.
And so sad.
And that's another thing, too, I think, to the film's credit, is, again, I had never felt more convinced of this man's guilt, but at the same time, I felt so kind of sad for him at the end, in that last chapter, and all the things that you just watch his life kind of going down and down. And again, you've already seen this horrible stuff that he's potentially done, and yet I still found myself sort of feeling sad for him, which I didn't even feel comfortable. I was like sort of taken aback and kind of troubled by my own reaction, but I kind of give the movie credit for that, for allowing him to sort to be a character and to be a person and to see all these sides of him. But what getting back to what I was going to say is, do you feel like the movie missed him? Would it have been a stronger movie if he had sat down for an interview with them, or does the movie not need him?
No, I think it's much better for not having him. I think because so much of it is also about the perception of him from the outside, the continually changing perception of him, you know, it is about how he wanted, it's about also how he wanted to portray himself, right? That yes. he, the image that he wanted for himself. And I think, I think that that is actually part of the point. I remember there's one part where I think it's Goldman's father who says something about how he was, he would like smile when he knew the cameras were on and then turn yes. it off. And attached all of this meaning to that, that he was so calculating and all of that. And yet at the same time, you're like, well, of course, like he was trying to play to the camera. This was, he was trying to win the trial, sure. you know, like that he's almost this, the kind of absence of his, him defending himself, his personal testimony, I think like works because it, he is the focal point. And yet at the same time, all of these things are being projected on him. Mm. I think that, I mean, I don't know, maybe OJ would have given an incredible interview,
right.
but I think it is actually better because also I think it makes him into this untrustworthy narrator at the end with like the things he's going through and the ways he portrays it. I think that it is better this way. Well, how about you?
I mean, I pretty much agree with you. I would just put it this way, is that, you know, better or worse is kind of hard to know, but I think it fits the overall theme of the movie, as you said, in the fact that OJ is sort of this symbol, this icon, this folk hero, and that by not having him speak for himself, it's almost like Rashomon. You get to see all the how these different people see him and how they each use him for whatever their purposes are. And so not having him speak kind of fits that aspect of the movie, whereas if he was able to sit there and say, well, I didn't think this and I didn't think that, or I did this or I didn't do that, it may have weakened that component of the movie, which is so strong. So while I would be sort of fascinated to know what that version of the movie looks like, I don't necessarily feel like the movie is missing him or is weakened by his absence, because I think Ezra Edelman, the guy who made the movie, I think very cannily sort of structured it in a way where his absence sort of fits, because it doesn't seem like anybody really knew this guy, or that they knew an aspect of him, but that he was so complex or guarded or just or putting on this front, that the real OJ was and probably forever will be a mystery. No yes. matter how long your documentary about him is.
I agree. Well, that is OJ Made in America. You can find it on iTunes or on the ESPN app. And as you've heard, we both highly recommend it. It is pretty magnificent.
Okay, so Q Shots, we're doing 30 for 30, the ongoing ESPN series of, you know, anthology documentaries. I did want to say, because actually I was talking to one person who didn't realize the title 30 for 30 originates with the sort of the very beginning of the project was, well, it was going to be the 30th anniversary of ESPN. I think this is all the way back in like 2009. That's how long yeah. ago they started this, and they, to commemorate the anniversary, they commissioned 30 documentaries. So, and they each one for that first batch was specifically about an event from ESPN's first 30 years. It couldn't take place in 1960 or something like that. It had to be between 79, I guess, and 2009, hence the title 30 for 30. Now, at this point, there's almost 100 of these, so the title has almost no meaning. It's kind of like KFC or something. They've divorced it from its original meaning. But I think at this point, the brand of 30 for 30 is so strong that there was no, you know, what were they? They were going to change it and get rid of that, just throw it away. I don't think that would have made sense. So that's why it's 30 for 30, in case you did not know that. And a lot of these are available, especially on Netflix, has dozens of them.
Yeah, both of mine are on Netflix.
Both of mine are on Netflix as well. So if you like sports docs, you haven't seen these, they're all available on Netflix. There's a lot more where these came from as well. So, Allison, I think you're going to go first because yours sort of connects to O.J. Made in America.
It does. My first pick is June 17th, 1994, which does serve as a kind of companion piece to O.J. It is about the day that O.J. Simpson was meant to turn himself into the police, and instead he didn't show up. And what took place was the infamous white Bronco chase down the freeway, the slow-speed chase, Simpson with a gun to his head. This movie is directed by Brett Morgan, who directed Chicago 10 and Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck, and Kid Stays in the Picture. It was also a listener rec a few months ago from Cyrus. Wanted to give a shout out to that. And I picked this one not just because of the OJ connection, but because the 30 for 30 docs as a whole, they have a lot of variety in terms of subject matter. They're not always known for being the most formally inventive.
Nope.
But this is one that is genuinely, I think, engaging in terms of its format.
Yeah.
No interviews, no narration. It just flips between various significant sports events during the day. It was a day with a lot going on. Arnold Palmer, the legendary golfer, was playing his last round of golf at the U.S. Open as a pro, or as like a non-senior pro. The World Cup was kicking off in Chicago with Bill Clinton announcing how soccer unites the world. The New York Rangers had just won the Stanley Cup and were celebrating with a parade in New York. It was an NBA Finals game between the Rockets and the Knicks. Ken Griffey Jr. Managed to tie Babe Ruth's record for the most home runs before July. And then, of course, over the course of the day, the OJ coverage slowly devours all of this and seeps into all of it. And Morgan sometimes literally uses a device that recalls channel flipping.
Yes.
You know, it goes between sometimes unrelated channels. There's a tracking on the screen. Mm-hmm. It also incorporates raw feeds when people aren't live on air but are being recorded. So you hear from people on helicopters, like trying to track down the Bronco, from Bob Costas talking with his producers about how they're going to handle the news while covering this very important basketball game. And the film, I mean, allows there to be kind of connections, not like small coincidental ones. One person announces at a certain point that the way that all of these people are like lining up to see OJ pass by, like on the overpasses and along the side of the road, it looks like a parade.
Right.
And from there,
and then
the
you
film
cuts to
like a boy in the parade.
Yeah.
In the Rangers parade talking about it. I don't think that there is an explicit condemnation in this film, but I do think there is a profound ambivalence that there are ways in which spectacle is spectacle, no matter what sort, you know, and that we watch people succeed at these great athletic achievements or fail with equal raptness, that people are, when the end, which has a really great use of the Talking Heads song, Heaven, has all of these people, like news media, but also just members of the public, like outside the house, pushing and shoving and trying to see what's going on. And their engagement and their like kind of their hunger to be there and see things is equal to, I think, the fans who are there, like showing off their Rangers tattoo at the parade, and to the people cheering in the stands. There is no particular line to be drawn, you know. It is all just people watching the spectacle. And I think that there is a great and very sad poetry to that, that the film captures really well in less than an hour. It's not a longer film. It also includes, and I don't think this is in OJ Made for America, the like like too good to be true detail that after in the press conference after OJ made it home after the Bronco chase, that he settled in and he drank a glass of orange juice, and the people in the press conference cannot help but laugh.
Mm-hmm.
It is really, I think, a impressive achievement, and in a group of films that I think are made to be informative first and foremost, that it manages to capture this meditation on the strange forces of this one day, and also the forces of just like watching and spectacle. So that is June 17th, 1994. It is streaming on Netflix.
Yeah, that's definitely, as you said, there are some great 30 for 30s, but a lot of them, they sort of feel of a piece. And I mean, even though it's an anthology, I guess that makes sense, you know, that they would feel kind of aesthetically kind of similar. But that is really one of the few that stands out and doesn't have any talking heads and is just it almost feels like an experimental film or an art film.
Like it would play on a gallery wall.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. That's a great pick. My first pick was from that first batch of 30 for 30s, like June 17th, 1994 is. And it's taken on new resonance, I think, in recent months. It's called Small Potatoes, Who Killed the USFL by director Mike Tolan. And the USFL was an attempt to create another professional football league, unlike the NFL, that would play in the spring. And it was formed in 1983. And while it got off to a pretty promising start, it folded by 1985. And one reason why it folded so quickly is that this one very ambitious team owner pushed the USFL to go from playing in the spring when they didn't have the NFL to compete directly with to playing in the fall when they would have to go up against the NFL. And the name of that owner is Donald Trump. He purchased the New Jersey Generals. In the film, basically, they make it seem like he kind of did it as a status symbol. And then, again, according to the film, essentially drove the franchise and the entire league right into the ground. And Mike Tolan was the guy who made this movie and the right guy to make it because he was actually present for a lot of this. He worked for the USFL in the early 80s. He basically worked for their equivalent of NFL films, shooting stuff, putting together packages and videos. So he had access to the footage of the league, and he was able to get a lot of interviews with the major players in the league, both players in the sense of the players and also the executives and things like that. And he also convinced Donald Trump himself to sit down for an interview, somewhat reluctantly, it seems, based on the footage in the film, to weigh in on what went wrong in his mind. And we see the same interview played both in the beginning and the end of the film. And at the end of the interview, Trump basically throws his hands up and says, well, you know, it happened, but even if it had stuck around, the USFL would be Small Potatoes, which is where the title of the film comes from. So when this doc came out in 2009, it was an interesting story. I think the USFL is, it's a sort of a fascinating chapter of sports history that's largely forgotten or unknown, and that alone makes it interesting. But now, 7 years later, it is this fascinating window into the mindset of this guy who is now a presidential candidate who talked, if not outright bullied, his way into the league and then brought it down, essentially. Burt Reynolds, the actor, also owned a USFL franchise, the Tampa Bay Bandits, named after Smokey and the Bandit. And he says in the film that what Trump really wanted was to own an NFL franchise. And when that didn't work, he bought into the USFL. And essentially, his reasoning in Burt's mind to move the league to this fall was to kind of prove his point, get revenge, destroy the NFL, fuel his ego, you know, for having them scolded and cast
totally
him aside.
Out of character.
Right. And that's the stuff that's so fascinating. And actually, the USFL, not to spoil everything in the movie, but they sued the NFL for antitrust, as like saying they're a monopoly. They hold this monopoly and they're destroying competition. And the USFL won. The jury found for the USFL, but basically because Trump had already and the league in general, I'm not going to blame Trump entirely, but that they had basically shut down by this point, so there was no damages to award. So the league was awarded, they won, but they were awarded $3.76 in damages. So at one point in the film, we see the actual check from the NFL handed over to Trump himself to look at, and you can see how unhappy he is to be confronted with what is clearly a failure from his life, and how that is so anathema to his image that he had, even in 2009, had built. And I think that that is what makes this one so interesting now, even more interesting than when it came out. So something worth watching on Netflix. It is available on Netflix. It's Small Potatoes, Who Killed the USFL?
All right. Well, for my second pick, I promise figure skating.
Oh, here we go.
I'm going to talk figure skating.
Okay.
You know, something that is commonly said about the 30 for 30 films is that they're not just sports documentaries. You know, they use sports as a jumping off point for bigger things or for telling stories that are not the ones you expect. And I think that is sometimes true. I think that OJ Made in America is the best possible version
Absolutely.
Of that. And I think that there are ones that have introduced me to context and background and history that I had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
But let's be honest, some of them are just so nerdily specific about some particular. They are made.
Yeah.
There are some that are very clearly made for sports fans of a particular. It's a particular aspect of sports. People who are already on board with the subject matter to begin with. And so I wanted to talk about a movie that is about a sport that I am actually interested in. That movie is 2014's The Price of Gold, which is about Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan and the lead up to and including the 1994 Winter Olympic Games in Lillehammer. That would be the year that Kerrigan was attacked by what turned out to be a man hired by Harding's then husband or ex-husband. I believe they had separated and then got back together, Jeff Galooly, and her bodyguard, Sean Eckert, in an attempt to make Kerrigan unable to compete. As you may or may not recall,
yes.
They ruled that Kerrigan, even though Kerrigan couldn't skate in the qualifiers, she was made one of the two skaters that they sent up, and the other one was Harding. And Kerrigan came in.
Right. If you wrote this, no one would believe
it. It's such a good story. And that's, I think, what shines through in this is that it is such a good story and was such a big moment for figure skating in the national spotlight.
Definitely.
And a kind of like an uncomfortable moment for figure skating in the national spotlight because the tradition of figure skating is that it is this impeccable, classy,
elegant,
it's dancing
grace.
On ice.
Yes.
Yeah, and that is actually one of the things that this film, which is directed by Nanette Bernstein, represents. Nanette Bernstein, who did American Teen and Going the Distance, and who actually co-directed The Kid Stays in the Picture
with
Brett Morgan.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to say mention this connection between your two choices.
My first cue shots pick. And I think what is something that should be noted about this film is that in making it, Bernstein was not able to get an interview with Nancy Kerrigan because Nancy Kerrigan had promised an exclusive to NBC for their competing documentary, Nancy and Tonya, because she had signed a deal to be a skating analyst for the network for the Sochi Olympics.
Right.
You can watch Nancy and Tonya at NBCSports.com. It is also streaming. It's about an hour. It is much more of a television special than it is, I would say, like a documentary in the sense of a film. But I do recommend you watch it because they work incredibly well together as a pair. One, The Price of Gold kind of tilts towards Harding's perspective, and the other tilts towards Kerrigan's. Harding does participate in Nancy and Tonya. But it is also about their perceptions of one another and how that those perceptions fit into figure skating and the idea of what the ideal female figure skater looked like.
Right.
Because these are both working class women. You know, Kerrigan was the one who figured out how to, and her team figured out how to fit into the ice princess image, right? She was very classy. She was very, her figure skating was all about these like long, elegant lines, Vera Wang outfits. She was, you know, very shy and in some ways that I think kind of hurt her a bit because she was uncomfortable interacting with the press and with the crowd, was often caught saying like kind of snippy things when her mic was live. But Kerrigan was still obviously fit into the image of what an artistic, as I said, they got the artistic points, you know, whereas Tonya Harding was this growing up in a trailer from a broken home, you know, was frizzy haired and was built the same way and was more athletic and was more into jumps. She was the first one to land a triple axel in competition, woman to land a triple axel in competition. And I think that idea, and also both of these women and how they perceive each other, when they both came from like fairly similar places, is something that makes these movies work in conjunction so well. Particularly, and I don't think that Bernstein's movie suffers in any way from not having Kerrigan, because Tonya Harding is the fascinating figure, and still has a huge chip on her shoulder, and has like gone on to like, you know, she was boxing for a while.
Yeah.
She, in a way that I think really turned off people, though I think it, for totally understandable reasons on her part, she is the one who really wanted to win because there is a lot of money in winning.
Yeah.
And she didn't have any money and was making her own costumes, you know, but that was like very gauche to talk about. Mm-hmm. Figure skating is a really expensive sport to compete in, but no one's supposed to talk about, you know, the money aspect. And she hasn't, you know, she hasn't gone on to be wealthy, whereas Kerrigan has, like, you know, went on to do like pro skating and endorsements. And Harding is so bitter, even though her life has become like stabilized and she's married and she has a kid. Her interviews are the ones that you want to watch because she is not apologetic and she does not seem to have a great awareness of just how much this is like eaten away at her. And in both movies, her interviews are certainly the more interesting. But in The Price of Gold, I think really digs into the psychology of Tonya Harding as this tragic hero slash villain. I mean, she is like a mini less murderous OJ in that way.
If you didn't say it, I was going to say it is that. And then I think the film is sort of like a mini version of the OJ.
Agreed. It's film about perception.
It gives you context. And because, you know, from the outside, again, she just seemed like this villain. And you didn't understand why she would do this beyond jealousy and just, you know, trying to cheat to win, essentially. And I remember rooting viciously against her.
Oh, see, I always liked her because Nancy Kerrigan was boring.
She was the victim.
Yeah.
And Tonya Harding, in my mind, was the attacker, the aggressor, the criminal, whatever you want to call it. And the film makes you see her in just the same way it does with OJ. It really makes you see her in a different light.
Right. And it leaves the question open of how much she knew ahead of time, because she was guilty. She admitted to guilt about learning about it after the fact, and not turning them in right away. And for that, she was banned from skating forever.
Right.
Or at least professional skating. Figure skating, she could still skate on the ice somewhere. No one would come out and tackle her if she like straps on skates.
But good clarification.
Yes. But I do think that it doesn't matter whether she knew or not, because it ate her life away.
Mm-hmm.
And she is this great figure
in
the movie, which is really well done. That is The Price of Gold. It is streaming on Netflix.
It's another really, really good 30 for 30. I recommend both of your picks 100% entirely. So for my next pick, I had already seen Small Potatoes when it first came out, so I wanted to at least see one 30 for 30 that I had never watched before, because there's so many of them. And so the one I decided to watch for my second pick is called No Mas, directed by Eric Drath. This is a boxing documentary, and I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, how boxing, certainly not one of my favorite sports to watch, but might be my favorite sport to use as the subject of a movie. The drama, the stakes, the intensity, the sort of the personality of the boxers.
Image is also a huge part of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect sport for film, for both fiction and nonfiction. And so No Mas is about one boxing match, but it's in a larger sense, it's about a rivalry between two very different boxers, Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran. And in a larger sense, it's more about what it means to be a champion and what it takes to be a champion, and sort of the heart that we always think about in terms of boxing. And that's, boxing is so much about, you know, the will to win and your heart, even more than it is about being a great puncher or a great fighter. You have Sugar Ray Leonard, who was, you know, sort of the, at least as the film argues, was kind of the next Muhammad Ali in terms of celebrity, just sort of like the most famous boxer, the most beloved boxer in the world at the time in 1980. He's the welterweight champion, and he's challenged by Duran, whose nickname was the Man with the Hands of Stone, because he hit people so hard. And they had this famously intense fight, which Duran won in a split decision, but then they had a rematch. And the film is mostly about the rematch, because it's in that fight that Roberto Duran, one of the greatest fighters of all time, according to some of the talking heads in the film, did something that he never did in another fight, and which has rarely happened in major fights, and which the talking heads, the journalists in the film, basically have spent the last 30 years trying to understand. He quit in the middle of the match. He wasn't knocked down. The ref didn't, you know, stop the fight on his behalf. He said No Mas, threw up his hands, and walked away from Sugar Ray Leonard. And so that's really what the film is about. And it has interviews with both Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran in the present. And I think the film does kind of, it answers some of these questions about why Duran quit, but not all of them. And I think in an ideal world, the filmmakers would have wanted Roberto Duran to be more forthcoming. They set up this whole thing where Sugar Ray Leonard flies to Panama, where Duran's from, and they meet. They sort of set up this shoot in the middle of a boxing ring, and they kind of talk about the incident, their relationship, and what they each think happened. And I think they hoped that Duran would be more open about his decisions. And what you see in the film is maybe not that, but in a way, it suits the movie, much in the way that not having O.J. on camera and O.J. Made in America kind of works. I think the sort of the way that he tries to, Duran tries to kind of avoid the thorny subject at the center of it, it suits the movie, and in some ways it suits 30 for 30 in general, in the way that these are, as you said, some of these are about sort of singular moments in sports, but some of them are also about larger issues. And this one is about sort of, again, like the makeup of a champion. And I feel like that's something that's, you know it when you see it, but it's hard to explain. Like, this is not a riddle that can be solved or understood. And that's part of what we love about sports too, is these moments that are inexplicable. You know, again, the idea that something is so crazy that if you wrote it in fiction, you wouldn't believe it. Like the fact that one of the toughest fighters in history just quit in the middle of a match, and to this day won't really fully explain why he did it. I mean, that is just a great moment that, you know, it's as good as any mystery in like a Christopher Nolan movie. You can have your, you know, you can have your theory, and the movie presents a ton of different theories, but in the end, it's like, it's something we'll never fully know. And I kind of like that about the movie, is that it allows the ambiguity to kind of continue, the mystery to continue.
I should say there is a scripted film on this topic.
Oh, really?
Starring Edgar Ramirez and Robert De Niro as his trainer.
Right.
It was at Cannes.
That's right.
But the press screening was canceled.
That's
Weinstein
right.
Company owns it. And, I mean, it seems like an Oscar-y movie, except that I don't know anyone who really saw it. I'm sure people did, and it was reviewed.
Is it called Hands of Stone?
Hands of Stone.
Right, after Duran's nickname there. Yeah.
And so that may or may not be coming out this year, but it is about this boxer.
Interesting. Well, in the meantime, while you're waiting for that, No Mas, which is very good, is available on Netflix. Okay, let's talk about some new movies. Singer and Wilmore's completely concise and totally succinct new release roundup. And usually this is one of my favorite parts of the show, Allison, because we get to talk about new movies. We know we don't have to restrict ourselves to streaming. But, man.
This summer is grim.
Yeah, I have a whole article up on screencrush.com you may want to read about. Where I basically ask, is this the worst summer for movies ever, or at least in the last... Right.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what the question I found was that if we look at every year, based on the scores on Rotten Tomatoes, generally every year is about the same in terms of wide releases. But in terms of the biggest of the big, movies over $100 million in budget, this is the worst year of the last decade except for one. And we still have time to go. So it's possible that this really could be the worst year for tentpole releases in a decade, depending on how July and August shake out, if Ghostbusters is a bomb, if Jason Bourne is a bomb, if Suicide Squad is a bomb. We could actually have, like, mathematically the worst blockbuster summer season in a long time.
Well, I think what's weirder than just how bad, or just not even bad as much as like unwanted, a lot of these movies have felt like, mm-hmm. It's just that we've just had, you know, we're recording this on 4th of July weekend, which is like the biggest traditionally,
that's right,
summer weekend.
That's that.
And the movies that were released are
the BFG,
which we've talked about, and yeah, which is like a kind of lesser Spielberg
snoozy,
movie, kind of quiet
kids movie.
The Purge election year, which is like a low budget movie, pretty much. It's under $10 million. It's a $10 million movie, you know. That is like, is not your like tentpole.
No.
And then Tarzan, which is not good.
No.
The Legend of Tarzan.
The Legend of Tarzan. This is another of the, I would say, horrible, huge movies. I think this movie cost like, I think $180 million or something.
That's
like
a lot
that.
Of money.
I'll double check while we're talking, but it's well over $100 million spent on a Tarzan movie. And with not like, not huge stars either. There's no mega star to anchor this thing either.
Beyond like not having a big star, you just, when you watch it, you're like, no one seems to be into this.
No
one participating seems to have any actual sense of why this, and why they should make another Tarzan movie, why anyone would want to watch that.
No.
Like, it is such a limp movie. That looks incredibly expensive.
It does look beautiful and
which is like lavish. It's like
so beautiful. The sweeping shots of Africa and like the establishing shots of this movie are fantastic.
Sure.
If any of the characters
best that money can buy.
If any of the characters were half as interesting, and we should say in terms of beauty, Alexander Skarsgård, who plays Tarzan, is immaculate.
his upper body is. Incredible.
There's at least six good things about this movie, and they are all on Alexander Skarsgård's abdomen. I will say that. He is in incredible shape. And I actually felt like his performance as Tarzan, while the movie gives him absolutely nothing interesting to do, his physicality as the character was really interesting.
Yeah.
The way he walks and moves and even just stands. So, and you see a guy who was raised to behave like an ape. That is how he kind of carries himself, the way he kind of, even just the way he holds his hands at his sides. Really interesting. But everything else about him is so boring.
It's so boring, and he can't, like, I mean, this is a character who is given very few lines for, like, a lot of the movie. Most of the movie, he does not talk a lot.
No, he mostly just stands and looks
stares.
Sad.
Yeah. And I feel like you would need someone with almost inhuman charisma to seem interesting
right.
in that context. And Alexander Skarsgård is not that person.
No,
he tries.
They went for the guy with inhuman physicality
right.
and abs.
Yes.
Not the guy with the best personality.
Yeah. And then also, this whole movie, you feel like it's almost warring against the datedness of
yes.
the intellectual property it is trying to update.
Yes.
It makes Tarzan not just, you know, basically a new superhero who has all these incredible
clearly
physical capabilities
designed
and
to
can
make
talk,
him
yeah,
a superhero
and can talk to the animals and all of that, but also he's like battling colonialism.
Yes,
he like is intent towards the end of chasing the Belgians out of the Congo.
Yes,
in defiance of history.
Yeah, spoiler alert. History turned out a little differently than the movie did, which you would know if you've ever listened to We Didn't Start the Fire, because Belgians in the Congo is one of the lines in the movie, and the movie pretends like Tarzan solved
that problem.
Solved colonialism.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I think, like, for me, the most bewildering part about it is just how little anyone seems engaged in it. You know, like,
yeah.
they're all just kind of like, well, we're doing the best we can.
Right.
But then you're like, why even make this? Like, who cared about this
really
enough
don't
to greenlight
know. That's
it?
The thing. It's so baffling. Why make a Tarzan movie that is so... Tarzan at this day and age is so fraught in terms of the racial politics, the gender politics.
Right, you have... And Margot Robbie is playing Jane.
Jane.
And at one point, like, is told to scream to, like, call for cause. And she's
right.
like a damsel.
Right.
And you're like, but you've just spent the rest of the movie chained
right.
up to be
she
rescued.
Insists she's not a damsel in distress, and yet she is. And the whole movie is about Tarzan trying to rescue her.
Yeah.
So it But that in general is very much in fitting with the rest of the movie,
right.
which is like, this is a progressive Tarzan. This is an evolved Tarzan. But
it's the wokest Tarzan of all time. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like he's the white savior who has to rescue Africa.
Sure. And like very few of like the African tribes members are distinguished in any way.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
There
and
two,
they mostly
two
exist
them,
to be really.
Really
mean or to be like, go Tarzan, go.
Right. And yeah, I don't like why do this? Also, Alexander Skarsgård punches a gorilla. And he has that weird scene where he like
nuzzles a lion. Yeah, yeah.
And also Christoph Waltz and Samuel
Sam Jackson
are basically playing themselves in this movie.
Yeah.
Like neither
well, Christoph
of them.
Waltz in particular. I know you're such a fan.
I'm
so sick of Christoph Waltz.
I know.
He has to do something else. He has to find something else to do besides the same character. He literally plays. It almost looks like he's playing one of the Tarantino characters.
Samuel Jackson as well. I mean,
true.
It feels like they just showed they put him there and they're just like just riff. Just do your thing.
Did this surprise you at all that the Samuel Jackson character, he essentially plays Tarzan's sidekick in the movie?
Yes.
He is the reason that Tarzan goes back to Africa, and he is this kind of...
comic relief, basically.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
He gives this one speech, though, about his dark past, this past that he's not proud of, which is actually one of the best moments in the movie. Did you know that that character is based on a real historical figure?
Yes, I did, but only because I looked it up.
Right. I couldn't believe that.
He's also so incidental to the larger story.
Right. He's just there to sort of root on Tarzan, and I feel like to make it okay for all of us to root on Tarzan. And I was just like, I can't believe after you find out this guy had an incredible real life. It's like, forget Tarzan. Make a movie about this guy.
Yeah. Well, that is Tarzan. Yeah. It's now in theaters.
Worst summer ever.
Yeah. I don't think we need to talk about anything else. Let's move on. Behind the Eight Ball.
Yeah. Well, this is the segment, as you all probably know by now, where we wrap up the show with some new recommendations for stuff that's just arrived on streaming. We give you some listener recommendations that you guys have sent to us at SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. That's our email address. And then we give you one film chosen blindly by number from our...
My list.
Thank you. That's good.
Thank you.
You really just embrace it.
Yeah, you know.
Just feel it.
It's been a while, so...
Yeah.
No resistance.
I don't want to hog that. You should be able to do it sometimes, too. Allison, who's going first this time?
Why don't you go first?
Okay.
All right. Give me three new releases.
All right. First up, if you didn't get enough sports-related content on this episode already, I recommend Cinderella Man, one of my favorite Ron Howard movies. Russell Crowe stars as a real-life boxing champ, James J. Braddock, in this story that, well, if it had been made in that window for 30 for 30s, it could easily have been a documentary in that group. Maybe if they change it someday to like 70 for 70 or something like that, they can go back in time to this story of the improbable upset of a supposedly unbeatable champion. I haven't seen this movie since it came out, but I really liked it when it did come out. I thought Russell Crowe gave a really great performance. I'm curious to see how well it holds up. That is Cinderella Man. It's available on Netflix. Next up, also on Netflix, one of my all-time favorite movies that, at least according to my Google searches, I have never recommended on the podcast before. It seems hard to believe, but I couldn't find a mention of it in our archives. It is The Sting from 1973, directed by George Roy Hill. This is basically a spiritual sequel to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, in that it reunites Paul Newman and Robert Redford in another period buddy comedy. This time it's a con man movie about Redford's character, Johnny Hooker, trying to get revenge on this big-time gangster who's played in a fantastic performance by Robert Shaw for the murder of his partner. And to do so, he recruits this other retired con man, Henry Gondorf, played by Paul Newman, to teach him how to be a real grifter. And this was a Best Picture winner in 1974. It has great music by Marvin Hamlisch, adapting the classic ragtime music by Scott Joplin. Redford and Newman are great together. Robert Shaw practically steals the movie from them. Anyway, it's one of my all-time favorites. It's The Sting. It's on Netflix. Finally, as part of what I consider an ongoing public service to tell the world, anytime a new Arnold Schwarzenegger movie appears online, it is my duty, nay, my honor and privilege to announce that Terminator Genesis is now streaming on Hulu and Amazon Prime. This was the latest attempt to restart the Terminator franchise by basically splintering off from the original events of Terminator and T2 and creating this new altered timeline. On that front, it was admittedly unsuccessful. There will almost definitely never be a sequel to this movie, but I did enjoy it a lot more than Terminator Salvation, which did not have Arnold. I would say I enjoyed it about as much as Rise of the Machines. I had a lot of fun seeing Schwarzenegger back in this role. He's the best part of the movie, which, okay, at times is a little bit of a mess. It does leave a few lingering questions we'll never get answers for because there won't be a sequel, and that always drives me crazy as much as anybody else. But still, Arnold as the Terminator, highest possible rating, 3,000 stars.
Two listener recommendations.
All right. First, we have one from AJ in Lakemore, Illinois. And AJ has a 30 for 30 recommendation for us. He says, having mentioned 30 for 30 on your last episode, please allow me to recommend Slaying the Badger. While not a fan of the sport, I found this a riveting example of Greg LeMond and team cycling politics at a time just before the sport changed irrevocably, thanks to Lance Armstrong and various doping scandals. Other offbeat winners are Small Potatoes, Trump Ruins the USFL, which I mentioned, and Big Shot, an attempted purchase of the New York Islanders. Love the show. Appreciate your time and efforts. That's from AJ in Lakemore, Illinois. Slaying the Badger, I haven't seen. It does sound really interesting. Cycling is another sport that's so fascinating and so ripe for documentaries because of all the doping and all of the strange things
the
going
politics,
on.
Politics, like the team.
And the
like,
politics,
yeah,
the team dynamics. Yeah. So I haven't seen that one, and I really need to check that one out. And I would also mention that Big Shot, I have seen, the one about the Islanders, is a great 30 for 30. That almost was one of my picks. I only picked Small Potatoes because of the Trump angle. If I hadn't done that, I probably would have recommended Big Shot, so I'll second that one as well. Next up, we have an email from Damian Vernon, who writes, "Hi, Matt and Allison. Thanks for the great podcast. I wanted to recommend a recent sports doc to cleanse your palates after the disturbing OJ doc. The Barkley Marathons, the race that eats its young. This doc is about an ultra-marathon 100-mile race that makes the racers climb 54,000 feet along its path, equivalent to climbing Mount Everest twice, and must be completed in 2.5 days, day and night. The race is so grueling that only a handful of competitors have ever finished. This alone is compelling, but what makes it really fun is race organizer and designer Gary Lazarus Lake Cantrell, a chain-smoking eccentric who was inspired to create the race by James Earl Ray's Martin Luther King Jr. assassination escape from Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary. There are so many hilarious and weird twists and turns in this movie that had me grinning ear to ear as you watch people do the impossible for no other reason than it's impossible." And that is the Barkley Marathons, and that's a recommendation from Damien. I hadn't even heard of that film or this event, but sounds really interesting. And Allison, you noted that it actually is available on Netflix, too. So people can find it there, the Barkley Marathons, and thank you for that recommendation, Damien.
Okay, and one from your My List.
You gave me number 11, and on my list right now, number 11 is Out One.
Yes.
Out One, which, you know, all I have to do is raise a child and retire, and then I probably have plenty of time to watch.
All 7+ hours of the OJ documentary, and you said you'd watch it again.
Well, but I haven't actually done that. How long is Out One?
13 hours. Yeah. You can do it.
The plot description. I wanted to see how Netflix described Out One.
Yeah.
Strands of disparate lives intertwine amid the ebb and flow of 1970s Paris. In this epic French New Wave reflection on reality, perfection, and meaning. And boy, howdy, do I bet the people on Netflix are just gobbling that one up. They're like, I've already watched The Ridiculous Six and The Do-Over. What's next? Out One. Oh,
hey,
French New Wave reflection on reality, perfection, and meaning. Click my list added.
It's 13 hours. It's the time it takes to binge a season of television.
That's
and
true.
I'm not entirely convinced that it's more slow moving than House of Cards season 2.
Oh, snap. Snap.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe I'll try to. Do you think it's okay to watch like an installment one at a time?
Oh yeah, I watched it over multiple days.
Okay.
I will say it starts off like punishingly slow.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Well, that's
good
to know.
The first two like chunks are just really, really brutal.
Yeah, but stick with it. Yes. I mean, it's like a classic binge watch.
Yes.
You get through the first 8 or 9 hours, and it gets really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, I'll try to set aside some time. Maybe. Probably not. Allison, are you ready to count down some films?
I am ready.
All right, start with 3 new releases.
All right, my first is a cluster of films. It is the Albert Brooks filmography, at least when it comes to his work behind the camera. All 7 films that Albert Brooks directed. Yes, Real Life, Modern Romance, Lost in America, Defending Your Life, Mother, The Muse, and Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World are now streaming on Netflix. If you have a few gaps in your Albert Brooks directorial efforts, as I do, this is a great chance to catch up. So those are all on Netflix now. Also new to Netflix is Terror. It was one of our listeners' choice options, now live on Netflix. It wasn't when we had it up for vote, and I did want to recommend it. Directors Lyric Cabral and David Sutcliffe managed to capture an ongoing FBI sting in which an informant is paid to travel somewhere and attempt to befriend a suspected terrorist and then get him to say or do something incriminating. And I'm really happy that OJ Made in America won, and because I think it's terrific and was thrilled to talk about it. But I am sad we didn't get a chance to discuss this one because it is the kind of movie that you really want to talk out afterwards. So that is Terror on Netflix. And finally, new to Hulu is season 2 of Rick and Morty, the Adult Swim show created by Justin Roiland and Community's Dan Harmon, that was sort of in the beginning based on kind of Back to the Future parody, but has since built into the story of Rick, a alcoholic, amoral genius scientist, and Morty, his nephew, who he takes on really dangerous adventures without much care. I watched and liked the first season of the show. Season two is on another level. It finds a lot of pathos in all of this outrageous comedy, particularly the episode Autoerotic Assimilation, in which Rick gets back together with his ex, who is a hive mind named Unity, becomes this really funny and then brutally sad thing, and I loved it. So, Rick and Morty season two on Hulu. Give it a try.
All right, and how about two listener recommendations?
All right, first up we have one from Jedediah, who, in reference to our last episode about 1996, writes, "Another from 1996 that makes that list, and that you never hear discussed, is now streaming on Mubi and available for rent elsewhere, Nick Gomez's Illtown. Among the glut of cool, slick, and mostly cheap crime pictures that arrived in the post-Tarantino 90s, filmmakers like Gomez and John Dahl made low-budget, serious-minded crime dramas heavy on characters and consequence instead of pop culture references and body counts. Illtown is about small-time drug dealers, played by Michael Rapaport and Lily Taylor, who think one of their employees is ripping them off. Where your average crime story deals with hard-boiled characters to whom the solution is simple, Illtown focuses on human beings deciding what they're going to do about it, carefully weighing the decision to use violence. The cast includes Paul Schultz, Isaac Hayes, the invaluable Kevin Corrigan, and Oscar Isaac's Blink and You'll Miss It movie debut as Tony Danza's Boy Toy. Both Gomez and Dahl have gone on to have careers mostly directing TV, but nothing beats these early indie projects as writers and directors. I have not seen Illtown and have not even heard of it, so thank you for that, Jedediah. I will look that up. And secondly, we have, it's less of a recommendation than a meditation from Scott. Have you ever thought about the psychology of the My List? I have a long queue with some great movies hanging out in the middle that have been there for so long I have a hard time clicking on them. Many times, I'm not even sure why they are there. Recommendations from Netflix, Friends, or SVU. Case in point is Touch of Sin. It looked interesting, so I added it to my list, and it sat there forever. Later, it was recommended by a friend, and I bumped it to the top of my list. Still, it sat, and slowly made its way down the list again. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was the cover art, or maybe it had just gotten stale on the list because I had seen it there for months on end. Who knows? After my friend recommended it to me again, I finally watched it and was blown away. It is an amazing movie about corruption in China that still baffles me how it was ever released. It looks like it is not on Netflix anymore, but it is still available for rent. And then another of those cute movies I keep passing up was Dope, a fun, fresh, geek comedy set in a rough LA neighborhood. I'm really surprised this wasn't on people's top 10 lists of last year. What's on the top of my list now? Thebe. So thank you for that, Scott. We're going to say Touch of Sin is the recommendation in that, but I think you've got a lot of interesting points about the My List, which I think for a lot of people becomes a place where you park
the place
ambitions,
where
your
ambitions go to die.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally. Okay, and one film chosen finally by number from your My List.
You gave me number 10. That is A War, which is recently added to Netflix. The 2015 Danish war drama, written and directed by Tobias Lindholm, who also did A Hijacking, starring Pilou Asbæk and Søren Malling, who are both on Borgen, which Lindholm, I believe, also wrote for, which is a great show, and which I really like and highly recommend. This film is about a Danish military company in Afghanistan, and then something bad happens, and the commander basically faces war crimes charges, mm-hmm. and it was one of the Oscar foreign language film nominees this past year, so I added it to my list. Let's see if I watch it.
Get back to us and let us know. So, for listeners' choice options for our next episode, this is largely inspired by the death over the holiday weekend of filmmaker Michael Cimino, who made The Deer Hunter, which was an Oscar winner and one of the most celebrated movies of all time, and also made Heaven's Gate, which was from 1980 and was one of the most contentious movies of all time, one of the most divisive movies,
it's
controversial.
It's a famous flop.
Look, the movie very much destroyed a film studio in a lot of ways, or at least crippled it to the point where it had to be acquired by another film studio. And arguably the story around the movie is more famous than the film itself. But given Michael Cimino's tragic passing, we thought this might be an interesting movie to look at, to reconsider. And so we decided we're going to do that, but we're also going to do a bunch of movies that are sort of in that same category of divisive, polarizing, flops, movies that were poorly received on their first release, but have since gone on to have a cult appreciation, or perhaps even more than that, maybe have become considered sort of unappreciated classics in some areas. So that's option number one. It's going to be Heaven's Gate. You can rent it. There's also a fabulous Criterion Collection Blu-ray that is available. And it is directed by Michael Cimino. It is from 1980. It's a dramatization of the real-life Johnson County War from 1890 Wyoming, in which a sheriff born into wealth attempts to protect immigrant farmers from rich cattle interests. It stars Kris Kristofferson, Isabelle Huppert, Christopher Walken, John Hurt, and Sam Waterston. And famously, it was, you know, hugely over budget, and Cimino was constantly at war with the studio over it, and they forced him or took the movie away from him and chopped it down after its, you know, sort of disastrous first screenings. And so for a long time, it was only available in sort of a shortened form, but, you know, in the last couple years, it's been kind of restored. And in some people's minds, it is a masterpiece. I won't tell you what it is in our minds, although we have both seen it. But that would definitely be an interesting movie to revisit and to discuss. And in light of, you know, Cimino, I think he's a fascinating figure that we could discuss as well. And in some ways, a tragic one, too. So that's option number one, Heaven's Gate. That is available right now for rent.
Option number two is One from the Heart. This is the 1982 musical and romance written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, starring Frederick Forrest and Terry Garr and Raul Julia and Natasha Kinski. It is set in Las Vegas. It's about a mechanic and a travel agent who've been married 5 years, and their marriage is kind of falling apart a bit. Franny, she wants to have adventures. Hank, you know, things are fine. And they go out for a night and meet like these ideal lovers and have to consider whether to stay married or to call it quits. This movie was hugely over budget and almost bankrupted American Zoetrope, or Zoetrope as it was called at the time. And it's mostly shot on sound stages deliberately to give it this very stylized look, with music from Crystal Gayle and Tom Waits. And it, for years afterwards, Coppola was set on a path of making these more commercial films, because including Godfather 3, to pay off his debts that he ran up for this movie. It did not perform well at the time, though it's definitely got a small but passionate fandom, including me. I like this one. You have not seen it, Matt.
I have not seen it. So this is one that actually would be very interested in watching for the first time. I've heard you talk about it.
And yeah, I talked about it, I think, on maybe Film Spot or SVU number 12. It was one of the early episodes.
Long time ago.
When we were talking about the 70s and that kind of era in filmmaking. Though this is 1982. But that is streaming on Amazon Prime and also available for rent. That is One from the Heart.
All right, our third option, another one. I've actually never seen this one.
I haven't either.
This one maybe is, well, they're all really appropriate for the topic, but this one seems really appropriate in terms of a movie that was just hugely kind of dismissed at the time and has only steadily increased in sort of its critical standing. Probably, you would agree, right, that of the three, this is probably considered the best of the three films. Would you agree with that or no?
Yeah, I would agree. It's always hard to tell because the people who are fans of these films are very passionate.
That's
fair.
And
so, like, it's hard to judge.
Maybe my perspective is skewed, but that's how I perceive it anyway. The film is Sorcerer, and it is available for rent, directed by William Friedkin. This is from 1977. It is a loose remake, although I don't think Friedkin likes to refer to it this way, as a remake of The Wages of Fear, which I have seen and is a masterpiece. That's a great film. And so he sort of loosely remade the movie with Roy Scheider. The plot description is, four unfortunate men from different parts of the globe agree to risk their lives transporting gallons of nitroglycerin across dangerous South American jungle. And the premise is basically the same, but I don't think Friedkin considers it a remake. This is another sort of, kind of like Heaven's Gate, was a very ambitious movie that perhaps did or did not get away from its director. Maybe his ambitions exceeded his reach. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. That's something we can discuss. But the movie, by the time it came out, I think Friedkin, of course, was riding very high after The Exorcist and The French Connection, that perhaps people, maybe, rightly or wrongly, maybe some critics were kind of looking forward to taking him down a peg. I don't know. That's something we can discuss. And of course, it came out in 1977, which is the time of Star Wars, so it was probably just a bit out of the zeitgeist. Maybe it was really a movie meant for a few years earlier, or perhaps a few years later, because in time, it began to accrue a better reputation, and now that it's come out recently on like a spectacular Blu-ray, supposedly, it seems to have found more appreciation. So that's option number three, Sorcerer. It is available for rent.
All right, which of these reassessed movies should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can always enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, July 11th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter, at our Twitter account, which is at FilmSpottingSVU. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on the next episode, which will come out around Tuesday, July 19th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and you can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick, but in the meantime, follow us on Twitter, at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer, and follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, and where we share lots more streaming suggestions, both from ourselves and from you guys, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.